Can you hear me all right?
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we are here with Dr. Mark Ibsen, who is an emergency medicine trained physician working both in family medicine and rural medicine out of Helena, Montana. He recently starred in the movie called Pain Warrior, which is available on multiple platforms, including Amazon Prime. And with that, we'd like to welcome Dr. Ibsen.
Hello, Dr. Joshi. Nice to see you face to face at last. We've communicated a lot, so this will be a lot of fun
certainly.
Face to face.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very glad that we had a chance to talk. So, tell us a little bit about this movie, Pain Warrior, for the audiences, and what impact it had on you personally and the message you wanted to convey.
Back in 2013, the Board of Medicine in my state went after my license, saying I overprescribed narcotics to patients. And what truly was going on was people were being abandoned by their doctors, and I was helping opiate refugees. We can get into that a little deeper later, but I started communicating with Tina Petrova, the writer and producer of that film, way back then. I was like a deer in the headlights, as we all are when this kind of attack happens. And I got a notice from the board that I should appear. And frankly, I thought they were going to give me a trophy for what I was doing. I was really successful getting people off of opiates using cannabis and other non-opiate modalities. So I thought they wanted to give me an award. Well, they gave me an award and they stuck it where the sun don't shine. And you know, I hit a buzzsaw when I met with them and I was just shocked. That is not who I've been in my whole life. My entire career has been one of excellence and top performance and patient satisfaction scores and all that wonderful stuff. So I kind of smelled a rat, but I didn't know where the rat died and how decayed it was. So I was just stunned, and I started to reach out and look for other people who were going through something similar. I talked to Steve Arians, pharmacist Steve, and I talked to Tina Petrova, and then I met Linda Cheek, I was given a book by an attorney on another case at this time called Three Felonies a Day. And I read that, and in there's a chapter about what happened to Dr. Billy Hurwitz.
Yeah.
And I began to see that this is just not a unique situation that I found myself in. Tina was very interested in making a film about the suffering that patients were going through. And then she realized that it would be good to add a couple of doctors into the mix in order for people to realize that that blaming doctors for turning them down for their opiates is sort of dividing, you know, we all belong in the same boat that needs both plugging and bailing. And we began to theorize that if we were to include doctors in this whole thing, that doctors and patients together might be able to find a solution. And I realized that I was powerless as a physician to influence the narrative that people in pain were criminals. Yeah. She had some great ideas. We did some test videos on the lousy Skype connection I had back then. And she began to write and rewrite the script. She ended up selecting me to assist with the film. Actually, Tina and I have not met in person either. Wow. This all happened over phone and internet and all that. I ultimately was able to find a cinematographer that I worked with when I was in India, Ryan McPherson, and he took some beautiful cinema. He was able to mesh right in with a cinematography style of that movie. So I paid his expenses and hired him to do it. And so I was kind of a co-producer of the movie or a minor player.
Yeah.
There was a lot of delays in getting it made. So we started in 2013. The film was released in May of 2020. And I'm very proud of it. I think it's a remarkable film. I think that we were hoping that some sort of a different approach to the media would be a useful way to change the narrative. I'm a little disappointed that the momentum of this thing has just persisted, and it hasn't really changed much. But it's hard to ask somebody to watch a film for 80 minutes, but we don't have that kind of attention span in our culture. So,
well, I will say that watching this movie was worth it, because when I saw you come in and discuss your case, one of the phrases that really stuck out immediately was kicking the can down the road. You're taking in of patients dropped by primary care physicians or in between physicians, given that nobody else would do this. It was very interesting how by taking on patients, by fulfilling a need that was dropped by other physicians in your community, you essentially put yourself at risk.
Yes, and I had no idea how much risk I was taking. I would have done it anyway. I remember the first case. I remember it like it was yesterday. I get goosebumps talking about it. I was in the urgent care, and this well-dressed, obviously professional person came in on Friday afternoon, and he said, "You know, Dr. Burkholder used to be my doctor, and he retired. And I went to the office today to see his younger partner who took my case over, and he refused to fill my prescription." And I said, "Well, what are you taking?" He said, "120 hydrocodone a month, four a day." And he said, "And I'm going to be in withdrawal tomorrow." And I said, "Yes, you are. And I'm happy to help you. And I'll help you long enough to get you to another doctor," which is what you do in urgent care. You know, if somebody's out of their Prozac, you just write their prescription for it. If they're out of birth control, you write their prescription so they don't have a pregnancy. I mean, it's not rocket science when people are already on something to evaluate whether they're benefiting from it or not. And this person was clearly concerned that he was going to be in withdrawal. So I wrote him his prescription, and I said, and I'll try to find somebody to get you to. And there was nobody. And I was so stunned that nobody would take this patient. And you know, Dr. Burkholder is now on the board of medicine in Montana. And at any rate, and he's a good doctor. But he's in the same generation as me. And you know, we treated pain like we treat hypertension. You know, you might see a specialist every once in a while, or a cardiologist, but if you made the cardiologist write all the prescriptions for blood pressure medicines, the family docs would have nothing to do, and the cardiologist would be overwhelmed. So that's kind of how it's always been. You know, you use your specialists wisely, get the patient stable, and when they're stable, you keep them stable. Yeah. And this was like, how could you destabilize somebody like this with no indication other than "I'm not comfortable"? And this whole "I'm not comfortable" thing really gets my goat, because the patient's coming to me because they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's the patient that's uncomfortable. And I saw more and more patients in this situation, and I realized I had stepped into a public health crisis.
Yeah. What's very interesting is that continuity of care is paramount to healthcare until policymakers decide that it's not. And eventually you find yourself in this situation, as I have, as so many other physicians have, where essentially they change the policies to target certain individual physicians. What really stood out to me throughout the entire movie was your commitment to patients, particularly when you're in India. And when you're dealing with the patients in India, something really stuck out to me. You said, "I don't know if you can depend on me." And that really got me, because it showed your vulnerability, yet your dedication and commitment to patient care. And I often find that those are the physicians who are willing to put themselves at risk, yet find that risk met with criminal litigation. And so talk to me a little bit about how that mindset has evolved with you going through this entire ordeal.
Well, you hit on, you're going to make me cry now. You know, I had an emergency medicine career for 35 years, and I was well known for treating pain aggressively, because you don't get a diagnosis on a writhing patient. And you know, there was controversy 25 years ago from the general surgeons, don't give that patient anything for pain. I need to examine their belly the way it is. Well, it's a rigid, you know, acute abdomen, and you're not going to find anything out on that rigid belly. So I got people comfortable as quick as I could. One reason I did that is because of my own history of pain. I've had two back surgeries. I had a ruptured Achilles tendon and multiple kidney stones. And my first kidney stone was 30 milligrams of morphine to get me comfortable at the end of an ER shift, a night shift. I was peeing blood at 6:30 and my shift changed at 7, and it was awful. And so, I think the best pain training, the best pain fellowship is to be in agony and to realize that people can really, really hurt. So I was a ninja for treating pain when I was in the ER. And the kicking the can down the road idea is that, you know, I never wrote any prescriptions for more than 10 or 20 hydrocodone or Percocet or something. And, you know, I was always looking out for the gamers and the, you know, the liars and all that kind of stuff. But I also took my time with patients. And I realized early on that if somebody's coming to the ER to get a measly 10 or 15 Lortab, that is a low yield procedure, requiring 8 hours of waiting because the nurses can't stand these patients and all that kind of stuff. And I would always sit down and listen to them and hear their story and let them tell me if I had time, like at 3 a.m. And so most patients that I didn't treat their pain, they were satisfied when they left because I listened to them and I acknowledged that they were in pain and I believed them. There is something just destructive in this idea that you can't believe what a patient's saying, or that we have to be both caregivers and police officers. And that's the stuff that really kind of, I'm not the personality to be a police officer. I'm the personality to help you get a solution to your health problem. So I think I've lost track of your question now. I'm so passionate about this, So when I open my urgent care, there's two things I would say to patients. When I greet them, I'd say, I'm Dr. Ibsen. How can I serve you? Because that puts me on their level and on a level field. So they're willing to trust me to tell me their story. And when leaving, I would say, I will stand by you until you're restored to well-being.
Yeah.
People would weep, and so would I. People who were frustrated, who couldn't find an answer, who never had anybody really take their situation seriously. And I would say that to them, and it was profoundly healing for patients. And then I realized I had no business saying that to them because I was a couple of weeks from going offline. And that is the that is what's missing in the sacred physician-patient relationship these days is we're just trying to get this patient off of my conveyor belt because it's my conveyor belt is full of things to do. And if I can find some little thing like, oh, this is a drug seeker. This person's less than human. This person must be an addict. This person's trying to game me or lie to me. Everybody lies. I lie about my age. I lie about my weight. I don't care if somebody's lying to me. I can figure that out. Maybe not on the first visit, but within 4 or 5 visits, I can figure out who's gaming and who's not. And move them to the appropriate therapy, which is not necessarily risking my license to prescribe to them. But it takes a while to sort that out with a patient. But if you're listening to them, you can do it.
I like how you phrased believing the patient and the element of trust as a way of treating the pain itself. In the movie, there are certain portions where there is a Dr. Jacobs who comes in and in many ways provides very sage quotations. And one of the things he mentions is that if we don't trust patients, society as a whole changes fundamentally. And I think you've experienced that when you treat pain as though you have experienced pain yourself, you see the patient differently than another provider, physician, nurse, whomever, that may distrust the patient initially.
Yes. And I found my attitude eroding. I never got to the hating the patients stage. But I did get to a stage where I'm writing a prescription for a patient and I'm actually wondering in my subconscious, is this the last prescription I get to write?
Yeah.
Is this?
Wow.
And I would say to my patients, you know, I'm going to write this for you and I'm taking a risk by doing so. And if you kill yourself with these medications, you're going to take us both down.
How did that change?
I was very frank with them.
So that level of frankness, being that forthright, how does that change the patient-physician dynamic? Because you mentioned multiple times in the movie about the sanctity of the patient-physician encounter. But if now you're introducing these legal elements into patient care, or at least making the patient aware of them, does that change the dynamic at all?
Well, the dynamic was changed by the case that the Board of Medicine brought against me. So it was in the headlines.
Yeah.
And so everybody was aware. And I think doctors are too terse about this problem that they find themselves in. And it's a big vulnerability to admit that, hey, I'm struggling with this too. And what I hear from patients all the time is, well, my doctor doesn't have the balls to prescribe for me because he's afraid of losing his license.
Yeah.
And I went deeper with my patients about that and said to them, this opiate thing is out of our control. It's certainly out of my control. They are after every opiate prescription. They're going to take them all away. So you've got to make a plan. The writing's on the wall. And I said that to my patients regularly. We've got to get you off of this. And 80% of my patients were able to get off the opiates because they did not want to find themselves in withdrawal again or abandoned again or betrayed by the system. The unfortunate thing is that 20% of my patients, I started to wean them and they started to die before my eyes. They were, it was failure to thrive on steroids. And I had to, and no one would pick these patients up. So they were mine. You know, once you see a patient, you have a relationship and you have to fulfill on that. And you can't just say, I'm not seeing you anymore.
Yeah.
Because then I'd be doing to them what was done to them in the first place. And it was just a terrible conundrum, but I actually called some people at the Board of Medicine and I said, you know, this person is dying in front of me.
How did the board respond to that? Were they responsible?
Oh, they said, oh, they would say something like the DEA would say, well, we can't tell you what to do. We're not doctors.
Yeah. So they themselves are kicking the can down the road, so to speak.
Totally. Totally. In other words, they could tell you what not to do. The DEA agents that came to my place 5 different times, they would say, Dr. Ibsen, you are risking your freedom and your license by treating patients like these. And I said, patients like what? And they said, patients who might divert their pain pills. And I said, doesn't every study show that you can't determine who might divert their pain pills on a first visit? You can't tell who's gaming and who's not. And they said, well, that might be true. And I said, well, Lynn, what do I do? And they said, well, we can't tell you. We're not doctors. And that's when I realized that I was in the middle of some sort of shell game and I'm the shell.
Yeah, seriously. It's very interesting how regulators at the state level, at the federal level, create these one-sided dynamics where they can hold you liable based on what you do, but cannot provide any constructive guidance. And towards the end of the movie, you talk about these layers of regulatory tape that have simply changed the dynamic. And you mentioned before it was just you, your attorney, and then the counter-attorney and the counterparty. And now you have this multidimensional levels of regulatory policies and policymakers. At what point does it stop making sense for you? You had a level of commitment, but for the average physician, it seems like there's a threshold that they're no longer willing to cross.
Exactly. I mean, it's not just about opiates either. It's about anything that is not right on the 50th median percentile. You've got to follow every protocol to a T. And that if you create something unusual for a patient, and even if it works, you will encounter some regulators or somebody higher up that says, oh, well, statistics show that doesn't work. You know, it's sort of like treating bronchitis with an antibiotic. You know, there's all these studies that say, oh, well, you shouldn't treat bronchitis with an antibiotic. It's we've proven that it doesn't work. And yet I would call my patients back. And if they felt they needed an antibiotic and I gave it to them, I would call them back and they would be better.
Yeah, that's and very interesting, because even healthcare providers, when they themselves get sick and it ends up being a viral upper respiratory tract infection, they'll still take antibiotics. It's the individual subjectivity in the decision-making that you cannot conflate with objective broad data sets.
Exactly. In fact, I came up with this idea. I don't know if anybody's ever talked about this before, but you know, the placebo effect is about 30%.
Yeah.
Well, I believe in the alignment effect. The alignment effect is, if a patient does a bunch of research and comes in with to me and they have sort of an idea that this might help them, and I do my due diligence and I find out that the therapy that they're asking for isn't going to hurt them, I will say yes to that. And the likelihood of that helping them is way higher than 30% in my experience. I can't prove this. This is just a hunch or a theory. But in application, my patients got better. And then when they didn't, they were willing to come back to me and ask me for my ideas.
Yeah.
And then we could get somewhere and we had a partnership. And I didn't see the patients as a threat.
The whole notion of shared decision making is very important. And I think you hit that on the head, where by empowering patients, you foster trust. By sharing in the clinical decision-making, you foster compliance and adherence. And I think we're so focused on quantitative medicine and legal aspects of medicine that we're trying to create this artificial conformity, and that's hurting patient care. And I think what we need to do is exactly what you allude to in the movie, Pain Warriors, where you have to see the pain for the experience that it is, unique to each individual.
It truly is unique to it. Everything is unique in the individual. I've never seen a single appendicitis patient that didn't have some variability to it. Yes, of course, it's right lower quadrant pain. It starts, you know, 12 hours after a bellyache, and they're a little bit nauseated and don't want to have anything to eat. Yes, okay, that's the classic presentation. But every case I've ever had has had variabilities to it, and you have to kind of be open to see the patient newly every time you're with them. But we have so little time, we just have to just jam them into a category and then get them out of the room so you can get to the next one.
Exactly. What's very interesting about the example you gave is how people in the medical profession look at subjective symptoms and objective data. So you have the right lower quadrant pain, you have the nausea and the vomiting, but you also have the leukocytosis, you have the elevated white blood cell count. That's a number, you can quantify it. And every time I would make a referral for a patient presenting with possible appendicitis, no surgeon asked for anything beyond the white blood cell count. If it's elevated, we'll cut. If it's not, we'll wait. And what's very interesting is this dependency on objective data. And in your case, do you feel like regulators were focused more on just some number, some prescription number, and not the actual care you were providing?
Oh, totally. In fact, that's why I suspected that they would give me a trophy, because I was having such great results.
Yeah.
The reason I got before the Board of Medicine is I fired an employee that was sort of an anti-opiate crusader. It would be like firing an employee who didn't want to get a vaccination at this year or something like that. But I fired her after she said, a patient came in and she said very loudly for the staff and the waiting room to hear, here comes another patient to sucker Dr. Ibsen out of drugs.
Wow.
And I fired her. And she happened to know the president of the board. And she was not smart enough to figure this out. So somebody else helped her, and I haven't figured that out yet. But I fired her, and within 2 months, there was a complaint against me before the board from that employee, not from a patient.
Yeah.
So a disgruntled employee files a complaint against me for the Board of Medicine. She named 9 patients who she claimed I was overprescribing narcotics to. And seven of those patients, six or seven, were off opiates at the time of the complaint.
Yeah, what's very interesting is the subjectivity. It's where the accusation forms the basis of the conviction, of the crime. And it's essentially creating a culture of medical McCarthyism, whereby any accusation has to be pursued and the accused are automatically blamed as guilty. And I think you highlight that very well in the movie. And what I really like is you go into different experiences about pain and the perception of pain. So there's your story where, as a caring physician, you are essentially targeted because you care. And there's so many other patients. There's a patient advocate who tried to help a patient from preventing suicide. All these cases where it's simply the external perception that overwhelms the reality of good clinical care.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so vexing. It is what has happened to our sacred, beloved profession is it's just a massive tragedy. And you know what, Jay, I won't stand for it. As long as I'm drawing breath, I'm going to fight this because it's I call it medical gaslighting, basically. But we're creating a false reality that everyone is adhering to, and it creates big gaps in our ability to care for patients and get the results that we are trained to obtain.
Yeah, and I think certainly we're now seeing some data to prove that the over-criminalization has adverse effects at an individual patient level and at a broad level, but it's coming many years too late. And for you being one of the first physicians to really raise your voice and advocate for yourself very effectively, how did you deal with the stigma, the immediate loss of credibility? How are you able to transcend and become such an effective advocate?
Well, I'm not so sure I'm that effective. When we get this thing changed around, I'll answer that question.
Fair enough.
But I think that some of my training has been around the aspects of transparency. Frankly, the Board of Medicine went after me in 2006 for a different item. I already knew that they were liars and that I couldn't trust any agreements that I formed with them. So what happened is when they came after me this time, I was sort of like, okay, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And I decided that I'm not going to lie down for this kind of treatment. You're just scapegoating me. You're sending me off to some medical gulag and trying to take my license away and using me as a scapegoat for this opioid epidemic, which has nothing to do with doctors. And that was completely obvious to me at the time with no data except for my own experience. So I decided I'm going to be transparent. I got the newspaper to do an article. I was all over Facebook. I did recordings with patients. Even before the movie came out, I have a bunch of YouTube recordings about me with me and patients. And I decided that we're going to argue this case based on the facts, not based on some inquisition that's going on from the Board of Medicine. So I fought back immediately.
Was your attorney responsive to this? Because in many cases, the attorneys tell you just simply stay quiet and effectively let the propaganda campaign proceed.
Yes. My attorney is a local attorney, and he represented me the first time the board went after me, and they accused me of drug abuse, and it was false. And even though the accusation was false, I had to go into the professional assistance program and jump through a bunch of hoops, and it was humiliating and degrading, and I was suicidal at times over that. So he saw me follow his guidance,
right?
And it didn't work out so well. And so when they came back another time, it made it clear to me that they're going to keep coming after me. There's something about me that they don't like. Could be how verbal I am, but at some point, he decided he would give me advice and I would get on Facebook anyway. He would say, you know, you got to keep this stuff under wraps, but he's part of the system. Right. It's basically, he's the guy who escorts you across the River Styx. You know, he's his whole business model is for doctors in trouble to come to him, and he helps them navigate the system because he's in with the board.
Yeah.
And I realized at some point he wasn't going to do anything more for me than help me navigate through this system and make a couple hundred grand for me. And nothing was going to change. And I decided that, to hire John Flannery in Virginia. And that's when we really got into it with the Board of Medicine, because they were determined to suspend me and go after my license and all that stuff. And I was determined to fight back. Yeah. And my fraternity, he stood by me initially. And then he didn't, because it was going to cause too much trouble for the board, and then too much trouble for him. And then he would not have his elevated status with the board in terms of escorting doctors through their nightmare.
Yeah, I think many people fail to realize the camaraderie that lawyers share among themselves that impact how well physicians are represented. It would be amazing to see the physician community share the same level of camaraderie as the legal community.
That is brilliant, Jay, because if we could stick together, wow, we could shift this.
I think initiatives like what you're doing with pain warriors and advocating as you have really provide an inspiration for so many people coming up who have recently been indicted or targeted by the DEA. So when somebody, what is the goal for Pain Warriors, the movie? Obviously it conveys pain in its truest sense as experienced by the patient. For providers who have been targeted or are pending criminal litigation, what can Pain Warriors do for them?
I concluded that I did not have the bona fides to get off nationally and say, you know, this is wrong and it shouldn't be going on. Because I did that for a couple of years and there was nothing but silence. I also realized that pain patients as a categorized, discriminated against group, it's a civil rights problem, really.
Yeah.
That pain patients are not going to get out in March. You know, it's not like Black Lives Matter or the women's vote or anything like that. We can't get pain patients out in a huge march to show up because they're too sick.
Yeah.
We can't have race for the cure. You'd have to have lymph for the cure. And so, you know, ultimately the patients aren't there enough to get out front. And I thought, you know, we've got to change the cultural narrative that lumps patients in with addicts. And by the way, addicts don't need to be lumped in this situation either. We need to treat everybody in a medical way, not in a criminal way. But that's another story. But at least for the pain patients, clearly people who have followed the rules, done what they were told, spent at least $1 million of their money and their insurance company's money, and at the end of that, the doctor says, "Oh, I can't help you anymore." That is just a lie, and it's racketeering 101. Basically, we're going to go ka-ching, 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 and then we're going to kick you to the curb. And I just think that this is kind of a remarkable thing. I was talking to my PTSD counselor about it yesterday. I have lost my white privilege.
Yeah.
And they talk about it, privileges in terms of doctors. And I have lost that privilege. I've been sidelined. And it just makes me so mad. And all of my colleagues who are in other groups, you know, immigrants, different nationalities, females, et cetera, people who've been categorized in the past, they're used to that shit. And I wasn't.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I'm still so out loud about it is I'm still outraged by it.
Yeah.
And you know, my colleagues who've gone through other things, you know, aren't quite so outraged maybe. But I think that I think that it's key. And some of the other groups that I'm involved with, we're doing a little bit more to make it clear to patients that being pissed at your doctor is not going to get this solved, or looking for another doctor to replace the one who just betrayed you is not going to get you what you need. We've got to either legislate this or you know, basically have a campaign. And we don't have any money to have a campaign. I mean, the movie cost about $750,000 to film, and it hasn't recouped those costs at all. I sent a copy of the movie the other day to Michael Moore, who was sending me an email to get money from me. And I said, well, I'll send you some money, but take a look at this documentary and see what you think of it. And then please make a better one. Because it is, while it's outrageous, God, I had to give up the outrage. It was going to eat me alive. And so, you know, I've done most of my work in the last 5 years to try to give up my resentment over what happened. And that has transformed me, frankly. Yeah. And you know, in the same way that 27 years in prison transformed Nelson Mandela, I want to be the person who's transformed by this experience instead of left in a smoldering bunch of ashes and self-recriminating and giving up. And I'm certainly not that give up person.
No, the fight is very evident in you and it's inspiring. Do you see anything positive in the recent years with more people speaking out? And while we may not have the tide in our favor, it is fair to say that there are now more active voices than when you first started advocating. So what do you see as a positive or some outlook that you feel could be more favorable in the future?
Well, there's lots of data coming out and shockingly, or not anyway, it doesn't surprise me anymore, but shockingly, a lot of people are ignoring that data because they have an agenda. And you know, we are up against some big time agendas. And those people with those agendas, the you know, the Shatterproofs and the Rumblers and the Andrew Kolodny's world, they have a racket going and they don't want to see it interrupted. And the DEA has a racket going and they don't want to see it interrupted. So those two racketeers have a lot of momentum and they've got 10 years ahead of us. And it's going to take a while for the truth to come out, apparently. And I hate that because people are dying while we're waiting for the truth to happen. I didn't get a chance to mention this to you, but when I left the practice of prescribing opiates to patients, 6 of my patients died. 3 by gunshot, 1 by an amitriptyline overdose, and 2 by alcohol complications, because alcohol is not a bad pain reliever. If you have 0, that's what people use. So 6 of my patients died. And I think it's, for me, my bond to patients is so close that it's sort of like family. Yeah. So if I was in some Western movie and you know, some bad guy killed 6 of my family, well, you could tell what the rest of the movie would be about.
This is the
movie of my life is about that. It's like, I think about those people every day. I think about Jennifer Adams. She was a police officer. She had a back injury. She had a bunch of steroid injections and developed adhesive arachnoiditis. She came to me. I could see that she was going to need opiates forever. And I couldn't find anybody in the state to take her. I referred her to Dr. Tennant. And she was going to see Dr. Tennant, you know, every 3 months or something. And she had a 12-year-old son. She struggled with her inability to make an income and take care of. She was living with her parents and the son's grandparents. And very proud woman. And she got a letter from Dr. Tennant that he was stopping practice because they drove him out of practice. And we can talk about that later. But, you know, the person who did his search warrant had 9 weeks of training in interdiction of drugs. Yeah. And he had over 60 years of practice. So she got that letter and she blew her brains out that night.
Wow.
Obviously she was out of medications and, And on the one hand, I'm grateful that my patients didn't kill themselves with medicines I prescribed, because then I'd be in prison. And that's the only difference. And how weird is that? Then I'm glad that my dead patient died from some other thing than the pills I prescribed. That's weird. I'm sad that they're dead. And I'm sad that they were essentially taken away from me. And I have a very unique style with my patients. And yes, some of them died because they lost access to their opiates, but some of them died because they lost access to me, because I had positive conversations with them and I would acknowledge their difficulty and I would sit with them and I'd hold their hand and we'd weep together. And we at least held it like that, like it was sacred.
Yeah.
And when these patients died, it just tore me up.
It's tragic to see what happens to patients when they're abandoned. Have you shared your story with any local or state legislators or garnered any positive traction in that direction?
Crickets.
Yeah.
I probably sent 150 emails to the previous governor. No, that's a low estimate. 500. The U.S. Senator from our state, John Tester, representatives, they're all on my email list and they just scroll by me. I mean, it's the same old story for me. So, until or unless I get the headline that says Board of Medicine pays Dr. Ibsen $2 million for the pain and suffering they caused him and they apologize for what they did to him, then I'm sitting on the margins. You know, my patients love me and that's gratifying. That really is. And my kids respect me. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
You know, my kids had their doubts at first. It took them a while, but they saw how this whole thing transpired and they realized that they both were pre-med and they're not anymore. No, they're not going to go through what I went through. But that's what I live for is the admiration of my children or at least the respect that they have for me.
That's very compelling. And we thank you so much for sharing that. Dr. Ibsen, before we let you go, can you just let the audience know a little bit more about Pain Warriors, where they can find the movie, how they can get a hold of you if they want to support you or advocate for the causes that you're promoting?
Yeah, I work with a national group, the Don't Punish Pain Rally people. Mm-hmm. We have a section in Montana. We haven't had any rallies since COVID. The Pain Warriors movie is on several video aspects, and Amazon's probably good to go. You can actually buy a DVD there, or just watch it. I hadn't watched it in a while and I watched it again a couple of months ago and I was weeping I weep every time I see it, which means I can't watch it every week. I what's really gratifying to me, Jay, is I get phone calls from people or a Facebook reach out or something in a message or something like that. People reaching out to me almost every day that are on the initial stage of, mm-hmm. I just lost my pain prescriber. And they're asking me what to do. And I have some Robin Hood medicine techniques I share with patients. And I just tell them, you know, you find another doctor, they're going to go away too. Somebody's going for zero opiates.
Yeah.
And I don't know who that somebody is. But it's, people are at different stages of shock. I mean, if you're getting your opiates regularly, you don't care about this issue. And when they disappear suddenly, then you suddenly care about the issue. And that may be why we don't have a huge movement going, because by the time 8 years of agony or 20 years of agony go by, the adrenal glands give out and you die. And I think that, some of my pain warrior colleagues are concerned that somebody actually is interested in the patient's dying to save money. And I say, you know, that looks correct to me now. I couldn't imagine that there would be some sort of unconscious or conscious national plan to kill off everybody who's disabled. The problem with that approach, if it were true, would be you know, 1 out of 10 patients is going to die, but 9 out of 10 patients are going to suffer and consume incredible medical resources all the way to their death. Yeah. And it's more expensive to not treat patients than it is to treat them, particularly palliative care like this. So I want that. I want everybody to get that. I guess the next step is, I don't know, write a book, get on the, you know, I'm very verbal, and I can tell this story really well if I get a chance. And if I found myself talking to somebody on a TV program, I could tell this story in a way that was compelling. And I think the movie does that. I just wish that it was compressed enough for people to act. But we have a very short national attention span, and I don't know how to cure that.
So for those who may be interested in getting a hold of you, what's a good way of contacting you?
I'm on Facebook. My phone number is out there. It's 406-439-0752. I make myself completely available because this is the mission of my life. I don't have any containers around this. I make myself available. I can't do anything to prescribe for patients, but I can sure listen, and I can sure have some brainstorming with patients who are cut off. And I have that conversation with patients daily.
And sometimes listening is the best form of medicine.
It really is. And laughter too. And I get people laughing. It takes a lot of time, but I get a laugh out of them by 45 minutes. I promise that.
Nice. Thank you, Dr. Ibsen. Thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the movie. And we look forward to continuing to support you.
Yeah, thank you. And I look forward to talking to you more. I think we're, you know, there's a scene in the Raiders of the Lost Ark where the woman protagonist gets the medal, and she comes out and she says, "I'm your goddamn partner." Jay, I'm your goddamn partner.
Well, I'm happy to be riding in that saddle with you. So thank you so much, sir.
All righty, yeah. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. Love you.